Some of you heard a song I was playing before, as you were coming in, and I was listening to that song the other day and kind of going back over thinking about when it was written, and I just wanted to share my feelings with that with you for a little bit, a moment here. And a man wrote this song before the days of the Berlin Wall coming down and before the days of the Soviet Union dissolving and going into separate countries, before the changes going on in South Africa and all of the other big changes that we've witnessed in the past few years. And this song has so much meaning to me because so many of the things seem to be, you know, coming around in it, and I just, we've been really blessed, I think, to be able to be alive during this time and see all the big changes in freedom for people. And the song is Imagine, and that was really his ploy there, was just to imagine it. And as I thought about and mentioned, you know, that thoughts are things and thinking ahead. And his goals were, you know, all the people sharing the whole world, the whole world living just for today, the whole world living life in peace. Then he says, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one, and I feel that way sometimes with my beliefs. And as you saw with my medical beliefs, that I'm not the only one, as you see a lot of these different books that are written by a lot of other people, and those have just been the ones that have written books. And it's just interesting to see all the earth changes like you saw in Diane's and Brent's classes and how things have totally changed. People aren't any different, and the mind isn't any different. In my view, it's constantly undergoing changes. If we stay stuck in old ways and old beliefs, that's just where we are. We have the same potential to change as the earth does. They were all created by our same creator. So why not that potential there to change? The dynamics and laws, you know, still prevail. All, you know, that change is happening and change is imminent. So that was just something I wanted to, I guess one more of his lines is, I hope someday you will join us and the world will live as one. And I believe that that's the way God intended it. Have any of you read All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten? Oh, good. I've skimmed it. I've never really read the whole thing, but I'd just like to recap the main little part that his credo that came out here. All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sand pile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything, play fair, don't hit people, put things back where you found them, clean up your own mess, don't take things that aren't yours, say you're sorry when you hurt somebody, wash your hands before you eat, flush, accept it, Holden. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some and think some and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Be aware of wonder. Remember the little seed in the styrofoam cup? The roots go down, the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why, but we're all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the styrofoam cup, they all die, and so do we. And then remember Dick and Jane books and the first word you learned, the biggest word of all, look. Everything you need to know is in there somewhere. The golden rule and love and basic sanitation, ecology and politics, and equality and sane living. And we'll say thanks to Robert Fulghum for that introduction today. So today I want to aim my talk towards grief. We had a couple questions on our survey, and many of the losses that your cohorts in the room have experienced have been a daughter-in-law dying, losing the hearing of a spouse, our children's lives, a dog accident, an aunt's heart attack, but not fatal. My son telling me to get a life. My aunt dying. Dog, and then family conflicts. Retirement. Husband for 2 years. I assume that was right after retirement. Am I writing here? Continuing chronic ailments. A job. 85-year-old mother to a nursing home. Probate. Death. Retirement. Relationships with ex. Children that don't care. Son's divorce times 3. Our spouse. Money and home. A lot of these were listed under major, and some of them were listed under minor, and I think I would make just about all of them major. The minor losses I think about are grieving my loss of leaving tomorrow, for one, which has come up for me today. When you go into a hospital, which is what I deal with on a daily basis, is grieving your loss of independence or your loss and your loss of health, because usually you're there with either questions for tests or to have something done to your body by someone else. And people think, you know, I'm strong, I can handle this. That's an old myth. That's not a healing attitude. The healing attitude is that I can feel this and I can endure it and I can move through it. We talk about tears. God gave men just as many tears as he gave women. And that's one of my lines to my male patients. And I've supported many of them to cry, and I always feel I have a victory when I've done that. God gave women different hormones, which helped us dump our tears a little easier. And I thank him for that too, because I've dumped a lot of them in the last 2 years when I've learned to grieve over a lot of my losses in the past, which sometimes are just little things, like a fear of being alone, a fear of being abandoned. I shared with some people the other day that I just got that one a couple months ago when a friend of mine had had some alcohol to drink, and I feared that I lost that person. And I realized at that time that when my mother drank, I lost her. Even though she was still physically present with me, the mother that I knew was no longer there. If any of you drink to the point where you get drunk, consider that when you're around your children. As I never realized it when my parents were alive, that I actually, although they never abandoned me, they never left me on a doorstep or anything like that, I felt abandoned because I lost the person that I knew, the person that I loved, because I didn't like the person they were after they drank. So, get back to my little notes here. Most of you are probably familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, or have at least heard of her. She's done a lot of work around grief and anticipatory grief and dying, and she's got a lot of books out. I was going to check in the library here. I skimmed through this one today, which is Living with Death and Dying. It's more anticipating of a person dying, going to be dying soon, you know, with a terminal illness or dealing with children dying. And I read it partially when my dad died, and I didn't get a lot, you know, out of it. It didn't feed me a lot. But her first book is on death and dying, is excellent. And then she's got a lot of little ones out now too that you can just kind of breeze through easier. But the first thing she did was describe the, you know, the different stages of grief, and it's been shown that people move through these different stages. And no, you don't go from one to point A to point B to point C to point D. Okay, grief's over. Bye, Dad's cut and dried. I'm okay now. It's not the way it goes. And we all know that. The shock and denial and anger. A lot of times our feelings, we're not usually upset for the reason that we think. That's one of my lines that I like. We're not usually upset for the reason that we think. Something has been the straw to break the camel's back, but it's usually something much bigger and more meaningful underneath. You turned the light off on me, and I'm really angry at you right now because you turned that light off, but that's not really why I'm angry. So look at that when you're dealing with feelings, especially with your close friends and your family and your spouses. You know, take them and hold them and say, you know, what are you really upset about? And don't take, you know, that reflection, that anger personally. That's challenging for me to do as a nurse because I get a lot of patients that are in anger. And guess who gets to be a scapegoat a lot of times? The administration, the nurses, the doctors. And I have to let them own their own anger and support them in it and know that, you know, maybe they have a horrible home life to go home to, or maybe they're, you know, totally going through a whole bunch of other stuff besides the fact of their illness on top of it. So think about that when you run across somebody who's angry on the street. There's a person here in camp that I know is grieving, and I've seen a lot of anger, heard of a lot of anger from that person. And I haven't had the opportunity to confront that person yet because I haven't actually, you know, really met them. But I know that's where their pain is. Their pain is in grieving for their family and grieving for their changes coming ahead in their life, and it's not necessarily at the person who stepped wrong in front of them. So we're not usually upset for the reason that we think. Talking about feelings a little bit, our percentages here, I guess I didn't do percentages on when everybody had their last cry. I went to a workshop on laughter and play. Karen got to go with me. And Annette Goodhart is the name that came to me this morning. Annette Goodhart was the lady who I mentioned, a few of you, who did the laughter therapy. And all the way through class, she had us going tee-hee. So everybody together go, tee-hee.
Tee-hee.
Okay, again. Tee-hee. And so you just tee-hee until you crack up laughing. If you have a hard time getting into laughing. There was a little boy down at the brick wall there below our lodge today going, it's a mouse. And we were just, Maria and I were looking out the window at this little guy, and he was running up to him, and then they'd go away, and he'd watch, and the little mouse would come out again, which is a little chipmunk. He'd run up, and he'd go back in the brick wall, and where'd he go, you know? And we just laughed and laughed, and I got in touch with that because it's like, I've needed to laugh. And the last, like I said, the last 2 years when I've done a lot of crying therapy for myself and working through a lot of things, I've learned to laugh at the little things more and not take life quite so seriously. I read the thumbnail sketches today, and a few of you have kind of that attitude too. It's like, you know, today is today, and laugh and enjoy. So the last cry we've got, it was a long time, never. It was a long, long time, and I don't know, and I can't remember. And then maybe 60 years ago, maybe 40 years ago, 35 years ago, 8 years ago, remember it for sure, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 6 months, 3 months, 1 month, last week, 2 days, occasional weeping, blank. And yesterday, congratulations to all those who wrote yesterday, and there weren't very many. Look, Annette said she has her patients laugh until they cry, or they cry until they laugh, depending on what type of therapy she's dealing with them. And I found that's very good for me, because if I realize that, you know, it's just the moment, it's just the thought, I can feel this way, I've learned that I can move through things a lot quicker than I used to. I used to feel doom and gloom, I'm going to be depressed for the rest of the week, this is an awful way to start out, and I'm stuck here. Well, I just created that for myself and kept it. And what I'm finding is, okay, tonight I'll just be down, and tonight I'll deal with, you know, I'll cry, and I'll, you know, whatever comes up. I find that within an hour or two, something happens and has totally changed what's going on. One day I was laying on the couch and I was really feeling sorrowful for my dad, who died 7 years ago, and I just really missed dad, and I was talking to him and crying, and within 20 minutes my brother shows up, who I hadn't seen for quite a while, and he had his daughter with him, who I hadn't seen for even longer because she lives in a different town, and he wanted me to watch his children. Actually, his son was there too, and I got to play with my niece and nephew and really enjoy them and get in touch with my brother, and he was there to hold me and hug me, and it was like, look at what I attracted because I chose to deal with my feelings instead of, I could have been in the kitchen eating because that's what I would have done before. So look at the things that you do that you beat yourself up with, the things that feel good. Eating feels good to me. It makes me feel better. When nobody's there to love me, I can eat. And I ran into that this afternoon. It's like, I'm going to go buy a candy bar. I'm going to go have ice cream. And so it's like, okay, why am I beating myself up? And it was because I'm sorrowful for leaving tomorrow. I also tried to create a little fear and say, well, nobody will probably come to this lecture this afternoon. And if they're going to stab me, this will be this time now. And I also felt a little distancing from a few people today with their different religious beliefs. And I always feel really sad inside when I feel those people holding new ideas away. But that's my own issues. And I looked at that and learned. Gary?
I have a kind of a confession to make. I was one of those who put down 40 or 50 years, you know, for having had a good cry. But I'm afraid of emotion. I'm afraid to break down and cry. And it's some childhood thing that made me afraid of it. But I do get all choked up. I, you know, even over a silly commercial on TV, sometimes it chokes me all up. Some cute child on TV, and I can't talk. And when I were coming down from the hill today, we were almost back in town here, and I was trying to tell her a story that, you know, happened, an airliner crash and the United States government responding to it. It's in Portugal, and I got all choked up and I couldn't even tell her the story. But even though I didn't have what you might have called a good cry for the last 50 years, I do frequently get so choked up I can't talk. And then I do have those inspirational moments once in a while. We had one last night that when they remember, I don't know how many of us saw this, these beautiful pictures, and I came to the garden alone. What was the name of it? Beauty of the Earth, something like that. Yeah. And Iola and I.
The Earth is
the Lord. Yeah, beautiful. And Ernie Ford singing My God and I, or something like that. But in that sequence, there's a picture of Black Hawk statues. Anybody ever heard of the Black Hawk statue? I knew of this. It's very little known. It's back in Northern Illinois, about 25 miles from Rockford and near Dixon, between Rockford and Dixon. But some local sculptor built this statue of an Indian standing there kind of like this with his robes hanging down. This thing's 25 or 30 feet high, and it's concrete. And the local people all know Black Hawk, you know, and Iola and I both knew it because this is where I met her and married her. And so we knew about Black Hawk, and she was, these pictures were coming on, stuff we knew, you know, Bouchard Gardens and Bryce Canyon and Yellowstone, and then they got some pictures of corn that came out of the Midwest, you know, the old, you know, back in Illinois, Iowa, and that kind of stuff. And Iola and I have a little sex noise we make sometimes.
This is great.
We need the feelings, you guys.
It sounds like this. Of course, it's quite spontaneous. And these pictures were flashing just like that. Bing, bing, bing. And here came a picture of Black Hawk. And I said, and she said, just there. And the interpretation of the noise he made was, hey, there's Blackhawk, and yes, I see it. You know, that's what it has other interpretations under other circumstances, but interpretation was that. But you have these little fleeting magic moments like that, you know, that can sometimes choke a person up, and you have very deep emotions about them. But it's true that I don't, you know, break down and cry easily. It's hard for me to do that. But I feel very strong emotions just the same.
So when you choke up, do any tears leave your
eyes?
Not
tears, no, I just couldn't talk.
I disagree.
Okay, so eyes do water. Good. That's really good because, you know, at this conference we went to, Annette said they'd proven that tears have an enzyme in them not present in eye water. So it's like when you cry, it's a catharsis. You are getting stuff that isn't supposed to be in your body anymore out. And we don't know, maybe that's the only way that goes out. And some highfalutin scientists, you know, could be thinking that, well, this enzyme, if it's suppressed from your tears, doesn't have any place else to go, and it goes someplace and causes cancer. And that's my personal belief, is that stuffed feelings can be a cause for cancer. As Louise shared in her book, a deep hurt. So stuffed feelings, we put those tears away. We were told it's not good to cry. Don't cry, be a big boy, especially. Or you're just a cry baby. You know, how much did that come out when we were children? God gave us tears. There's got to be a reason why. It wasn't just to keep our eyes wet. So when you see when someone crying, usually we feel that, I feel that I look ugly. I'm crying and my face is red and my eyes swell up and my nose runs and I know that my mouth gets in these weird contorted shapes. And so when you cry, what I've learned is just to try to forget how I look doesn't matter anymore, and to just cry. And if someone's there to hold you, if they can just hold you and not even pat you and say it's all right, because what are we doing if we do that? Right. Don't cry. It's okay. It's like, good, you're doing great. You're doing great. And that's what I like to support someone when they're crying. And it's like, let it out. You're doing great. And just, you know, if you have to say anything, sometimes you don't need to say anything. Just be there and hold them. And that's the best thing you can do. Same thing with children. Children are so innocent, and they laugh without being embarrassed or fearful. They cry without being embarrassed or fearful. You know, don't turn that off. Find out what their need is, and maybe they just want to be held. And I think we can all, if you can't get in touch with that feeling of wanting to be held, it's in there somewhere. And, you know, our mothers held us. And it's a good feeling. And I believe that's why we've got each other. If God made us want to go on a single journey, He wouldn't have wanted us to want to be held. He would have made our backs easier to rub. And so I believe that that's why we have other people in our lives, is to do those little things that help us move things through our body and keep us healthy too. So laughing, last laugh, I can't remember. 1 year, 2 weeks, last night, and most everybody said today within the last 6 hours or 1 hour, which was great, because, you know, that, like I said, that laughter, I used to be real serious and get real pissed off when somebody used to laugh, but I've learned now. There was a guy up there trying to do hacky sack this afternoon. He had some sandals on. He took his sandals off, and he goes, "Don't laugh at me, don't laugh at me." And it's like, no, we'd be laughing with you if we laughed. And actually, I was walking up the hill cracking up about something else. And I think he thought I was laughing at him. But he was willing to try, willing to step out and feel a little foolish and look a little foolish and laugh himself. And take that step. There was an artist at the Laughter and Play workshop, and his name was Peter Alsop. Have any of you heard any of his tapes? A lot of children's tapes that he does. And it's silly songs like Worship Two Nights Ago, which I heard at lunch. One woman very much disliked Worship Two Nights Ago. It was right down my alley. It lets my child play and sing to the Lord if that's what I'm doing. But it he did a song on, which one am I thinking about, Karen?
It's only a
week. Oh, that one?
So what's the big deal?
Yeah, stepping out and looking foolish, yeah. And that was what he did in the concert. Here's this guy, you know, he's a psychologist turned musician. And he's in his tapes, he's got a lot of guitar squeaks. So, you know, if you want to judge his guitar playing, it's not always the best. But one of the songs, just to get people to really think about what we take seriously, was his wee wee song. And it's only a wee wee, so what's the big deal? It's only a wee wee, so what's all the fuss? It's only a wee wee, and everyone's got one. There's better things to discuss. And it was talking about when you're born, people label you pink or blue. And, you know, it's just kind of cute on through. But a lot of adult children's songs. And children's songs. And the one I was thinking about, the children one was, I may look funny if I try to roller skate. I might fall down, but it's okay. It's like stepping out, risking looking silly, risking having fun, and risking doing something different in your life instead of just being, which I feel you're all doing just because you're here, which is great. So take this home to all your friends that just sit and watch TV all day and tell them there's more to do. Anybody have any discussion on laughter? Any people find it hard to laugh, hard to find things to laugh at?
Yeah.
We laughed a lot in our family.
That's good.
This brunch last night.
Yeah. I'm finding that, like I said, most everybody said today, and that was after we'd only been here a day. So whether we're laughing out our, I don't know if I want to meet you yet, or just chuckling, I know I found myself.
It's been a deep laugh.
Yeah. I know, just that innocent little chuckle inside sometimes. I've just really been able to observe and look around and really enjoy doing that. So how many people have laughed until they cried? Okay, so you got rid of some of those enzymes. How many people have cried until they laughed? You cried and then you just cry so hard and then it's like it's all over and it's a release and you'll find yourself laughing. The next time you have a good try that. Try to see where you're at with it and tee-hee it if you can't get through and see if you can pull out a laugh. The diaphragm muscle, the only way it gets that hard exercise is with laughing and crying. So Karen's taught you how to hit all the rest of the muscles in your body. And she's worked on laughter quite a bit because it's always funny to go to the classes. So just think about that, but that's the only way that one's going to get a lot of exercise is by laughing and crying. And you need to do it, Annette says, every day. I'll give you at least every week to start out. Think about it. If you need to go down and rent that good movie and cry in front of it, that's great, same enzyme. It's getting rid of old stuff. Getting that crud out of your body so you don't get sick. And I know that's my belief. You don't have to own it, but if it works, why not? Unresolved grief is something I'd like to touch on a little bit. And I like to use the story of my mother because hers was the most vivid picture to me of unresolved grief. I'd never heard of it until I went back to RN training and we were discussing grief. And this description that they gave of this person, it was like, sounds like my mother. And when I thought back and looked at all the grief that that woman went through in her life, her mother died when she was 15. At 16, she aborted herself with a willow stick. She didn't share that with me. She was 61 years old when she died. She did not share that with me until she was 60 years old. No one she had shared that with. Can you imagine carrying that burden around for 50, 45 years? She lost her first husband to the Navy, not her first husband, but the man she was in love with, the boy that she grew up with and carried her books to school and that she knew she'd be happy forever after with. Went to the Navy, so she married my father on a rebound. They separated at least 5 times, divorced once in the middle of that, and remarried. So you know, every time you have a separation or a divorce, you're going through a grief, a loss, major loss. So she married my father twice. She had a stillborn baby after I was born. She divorced my father again, married her childhood sweetheart, had his only child who had a cleft lip, and he committed suicide 3 years later. He was paranoid schizophrenic, they found out later. And then she lived a very lonely life. So in the course of her life, she developed alcoholism. She was very outward in needing attention and to the point of loud, raucous to me, not to other people. She was the belle of the ball. She'd always have the golf parties and the bowling parties at our house. And that was how she got her voids filled from her unresolved grief. She would embarrass me to the point with her loud voice sometimes. I remember we were bowling on about a 36 alley, and I think we were on lane 36, and I got a strike. And my mother screamed, yay, so loud, I'm sure they heard us on lane 1, and I crawled into the ball return, I think. I was so embarrassed because she was so overt with her actions. And this is a sign of unresolved grief, I learned later. And I know that with her, you know, after she lost the love of her life had not much meaning. Although she enjoyed her gardening, she enjoyed her life, what she did. And she'd drink some and she'd not drink some and she'd smoke. But I can see now how all those years she covered up that pain. And I had a lady who came into the hospital for a minor surgery. And she didn't want to go home. And I mentioned this before in that people don't want to go home because home life isn't as good. And she'd been married for 68 years to the same man and just taking care of him. And I realized as she shared her relationship, it was the same relationship that I had with my husband. And I was so thankful at that time that I was contemplating a divorce because this lady was so unhappy with her life. Life is too short to stay exactly where you're going to be. You know, if you choose that marriage is for life, then, and if it's not fulfilling what you need, then you need to look at other ways you can fulfill your life, even if you're staying married to that person, or to choose to do differently with your life. But I was looking at the grief that this woman was hanging on to her whole life because she was living out what she thought was right, but she was such a sad woman. So look at grief in your life and see if you have dealt with it. Yes?
52, statistics show that 52% of the people do not grieve well or have good grief.
I would say that percentage, she says 52% of the people do not grieve well or grieve adequately through to acceptance. I would say it could even be higher than that. And maybe in my generation it may get a little better with that just because of the education that's coming out and people that are willing to look and learn. I know my father's been gone for 7 years, and probably in the last year I've gotten more to the point of acceptance. The old line that time heals isn't something you always want to say to someone right after it happens, and we'll go through a few things of what things to say and things not to say when you're dealing with people with losses. But time does heal. It's not like I said, I'm not going to come tell you when your husband dies tomorrow that, you know, time heals. It's like it does for me, just because then you can get through the process, but at that moment of pain, most pain, you don't feel, nothing heals, because you are in dire pain. But I've learned and I've grieved a lot through the death of both my parents in the last 7 years, and both of the deaths were very different. Both of their lives were very different, and both of my grief times have been very different. I felt at one point maybe I wasn't grieving adequately for Mom, because my feelings weren't as close to her. But I've learned now that it's okay, and that however I choose to grieve, as long as I know I am working through it. Brad, the other night, I know a few of you got to Brad's talk on grief, and he did an excellent job in discussing the different types of grief. And one of his comments was that our lives, it is essential that we have attachment and detachment, or loss, for growth. You started out very young when you attach to your mother. The mother attaches to their child, and then the child goes off to school in kindergarten, and then they go off to college or move out on their own. And those are all attachments and detachments. And whether it's with, you know, the personal life, he used the example of his car. You know, he had a car that he had gone through a lot of life with him. And you don't realize that you go and sell that car, and sometimes, like he said, he went to the yard there and the place to get a new car, got his new car, and it was like he was just leaving his old car there. So he said he went and sat in it for a while and kind of said goodbye and detached from it a bit. But so you'll go through grief with everything on that. Karen?
A couple years ago before I moved, I went into the closet that I hadn't been in, got my son's baby things out, and decided to box them up to pass on to my sister-in-law, and sat on the floor and just cried and cried and cried and cried. And, you know, at that time, you know, he's a young man, you know. And but the loss of that baby was just overwhelming.
Just through each stage. Just like,
doesn't have to make sense, does it?
No.
No. Wonderful tears of grief. And sometimes we grieve for things that we wish we had. I grieve for the mother that I wished I had. I not only grieve the loss of her death, I grieve the loss of that she's never going to be the way I wanted her to be. Same thing with my father. So it's and it's not bad to feel that way. It's a feeling, it's a thought, it's inside you. So just hold it, cherish it, and let it go when you're ready to let it go. But acknowledge it. If you acknowledge it, you can move through it faster. Sometimes I'll cry, and it's like I try to get in touch with the feeling. Other times I cry, and you know, it doesn't really matter. You just let it go. So how many of you, when you come into the hospital, you actually recognize grief, or you feel fear, or you feel like your life's kind of being taken away from you a little bit? Are y'all kind of in touch with that feeling a little bit? A little fear of the unknown, a little I get what I get on my breakfast tray, if I get breakfast. A lot of times the hospitals aren't known for their great meals, mainly because you just don't get to eat. But so that's the type of grief that I'm dealing with every day, and my job is to help you learn what feelings are and that they're okay. They're okay. So I'm not going to spend much time on the different stages of grief. We mentioned shock and denial, anger, and bargaining, guilt, moving into acceptance. I think those are pretty cut and dried. Brad put this diagram on the wall in his lecture, and I thought I'd put it up here. He got it from Recovery and Loss, I believe, was the book that he got it from. And I've got the name up here. In fact, I think All Our Losses, All Our Griefs was another one he recommended. I know that one is in the bookstore here. And Recovery and Loss, I think, is where he got this one. They said that there's like 20 steps to grief. And I hadn't seen this picture before, and I wanted to share it with those of you that didn't get to come to that class. And so you start out like with number one, and it's like you needed to go through acknowledgement on all four of those levels, physical level, intellectual level, emotional level, and spiritual level, before you could actually move on to the feeling side. He said you could bounce these around a little bit. Like, you know, maybe you'll acknowledge here first and then, you know. But usually you kind of have to move from here and then move into your feeling modes more. Move into a substitution mode, something that you're going to substitute for that loss. Like if I'm going to substitute my new car for my old car, or, you know, whatever that works. You're going to substitute a good friend for your spouse, or your dog for your spouse. Whatever's going to fill that void. Because something will. In fact, in emotional trails of learning or of experience, when my divorce came about, I noticed that we had a triangle of conflict. And it's like this pattern. I forget the book that my sister described it to me in, but it's like a triad, and it's there. Well, I took one part out because my husband moved to another household. And it's like my daughter still learned that this pattern, like love equals this and this. And I found that she was filling that void by conflicting with me to fill this void of, this is the pattern that I know is what love means, or whatever is at the triangle. And I'm not sure of the book, and if some of you have questions and you can ask me later, I'll get you the name of that. But that was a really interesting diagram on how we keep those patterns. So the substitution thing is really important to look at that with, because we're going to substitute how we got that void. What if it was a spouse that you really didn't really want to be spending the rest of your life with? They did finally die. You go through guilt because you wished you'd loved them more, or vice versa. And you might find that void and fill it in the same way. So be careful. You know, be careful that if it's a negative circle, if you notice it's coming into your life again, that's why, and you need to just acknowledge it and move something positive into substituting. And then you move into a detachment, and then reconstructing. But it was interesting, like I said, it has to go through the physical level, the intellectual level, the emotional level, and a spiritual level. So I thought that's a lot easier for me to grasp this concept of grief and moving through it than looking at the stages that, you know, you can ping pong ball around in and never, you know, it's never from point A to point B. I still get angry sometimes, you know, that my mom and dad aren't here. You know, and then there's other times that I'm really glad that they're not. Yes, Diane?
Is there any kind of estimate of, like, time, how long it takes to go through the process? And how do you go through the process?
I believe it's ongoing forever. I would say that. I don't know that you can ever put a time on it. And it depends on how fast you're willing to deal with it. I know it could go forever in stage one, you know, or, you know, and block those feelings. You stuff those feelings, I don't believe you'll ever move through it healthily. So, you know, I would say to move through. Like I said, 6 years now, I feel pretty good, you know, after my parents' death. Has anybody else had any experience with that?
I'm just going to say, don't you think that that's where the saying time will improve it, is that you still have the feelings, but as time goes on, they become pushed back further, and they're not constantly in the forethoughts of your mind.
Or if you get them out, it's not that they're pushed back further, but you express those acute feelings, and it moves back to your feelings of love more, and get out your angry feelings and your bitterness feelings.
This is not a personal experience, but an interesting fact that we heard from a close former neighbor friend who has had some very, very hurtful family problems in the last number of years. And the parents have been devastated by it. Actually, it's based on a son who, after his bitter divorce, more or less accused them of taking the wife's side rather than supporting him. And he literally has disowned them. He's said and done very, very hurtful, painful things that have devastated the parents to the point they've spent a lot of time and effort in counseling. And when they went to a new counselor here a few years ago, he happened to be a Jewish man. And I don't know if there are any Jewish people in the room here, it doesn't matter, but he said, the trouble with you Gentiles is you do not know how to grieve. And this is bizarre, really, and we were glad we weren't living there at the time this happened, but he recommended that they go through a funeral for this live boy who had more or less disowned them and told them he wanted them to butt out of his life, and they were just devastated, believe it or not. And their pastor, their Episcopalian, their pastor went along with it. They had a funeral service for this boy, even though, and he's a doctor, it's just a bizarre story. And he said, had we been there, I know we would have been invited to be included. I don't think I could have gone. And I said, what's going to happen years from now? You know, what if they do become reinstated in their relationship?
Then it'd be like
if
a
he ever
birth.
Finds out that they literally buried him, how's he going to like them?
He buried them.
Well, he
by
did.
That rejection.
And yes, he has. I was glancing at some.
So it'd be like a new birth
start
for both
this morning. And there were some statements in one that I was thumbing through. In fact, I said I should go home and recommend this book to the parent.
B, did it seem to help them?
You know, I really don't know, because we haven't been that close contact since we've lived in Phoenix, and they're still in Minnesota. But I do know this, that two, three years ago, things gradually seemed to be healing. And they at least were allowed to visit them and see their grandchildren. They had never even been notified they had during this time. And things were going along fairly well. And then all of a sudden last year, they don't know, they can't put their fingers on what it is. The young doctor's son is remarried, and they don't know how much to blame on the wife and how much to blame on him or what. But anyway, you could write a whole novel on this family story.
There's a young man, I'm from Galveston, Texas, and there was a young man there, a Jewish man, who was telling me that he stood on the street and watched his funeral procession drive down.
For that same sort of thing?
Visualize?
That his parents?
Same, the parents were burying him.
Really?
And he watched his funeral procession.
Had they rejected
Jewish tradition?
And
then they
could
never speak of that person again.
Had he rejected the parents?
Well, I know with the Jewish tradition, if you remember, if you've seen the movie The Jazz Singer that Neil Diamond did, and the man tore a piece of his clothing, so their tradition of tearing a piece of their clothing when they disown a son, and if they don't go through the atonement, you know, and then, but I never heard of the deal with the funeral, but I could see their idea with it.
Well, I would say this was a total failure, because they've continued to try to still.
Probably the main thing with that
relationship.
The main thing with that is, when we have a loss, what's the most important thing that we want to do?
Accept it.
No.
Well,
change it.
We don't want to lose it.
Okay, we did lose it though. Yes. What do I need to do?
Replace it.
I need to tell you about it.
Yeah.
How many people need to share their stories? How many people are good listeners? I'm not a real good listener, but I've learned to be a better listener because I always needed the attention. I always want people listening to me. So think about becoming a good listener. In going through this funeral procession and accepting that their son was dead, probably what this family wanted the most was somebody to come up to me and come up to them and say, I know you must really be in a lot of grief that your son is gone. I mean, because he was gone. That's what she wanted. That's how she can share her grief with you. You don't have to own it. You don't have to take it on your shoulders, but you can be a third-party listener. And be there, be that shoulder to cry on, and things to say, you know somebody's lost a baby, or they've lost a child, or they've lost a son, or they've lost a spouse, and you go and you hear the things, God chose him, it's God's will, he's with God now. Damn it, I don't care about him with me! You know, that's the times that you're supporting those people, is within the first few weeks after the death. They're so in shock and belief, disbelief and denial and anger that they're not looking for any quick answers. And I know you've all been there and you weren't looking for any quick answers. Good shall come from this. We heard that come out in Brad's. Who's here? Was that yours? Yours?
No.
Their husband had died and they said that good shall come from this. And they're still looking for the good. Mm-hmm. I know how you feel. How many people have said that to you and you go, mm-mm? So unless you've gone through the exact same experience, that's not a real good line that gives a lot of support. And I know that when we say all these things, and we talked about time heals already, when we say all these things, what are we really dealing with? Our grief. Our grief for you. But it's actually how we're dealing with grief. Well, yeah, if I can say that God did it, that's okay, you know, but it's really your pain. So think about and really choose your words. And maybe you want to practice some, because I know as we get older that I'm going to be dealing with death more and more in my loved ones and my family. And things to say is just, I love you. I'm here for you.
I feel it a privilege to have someone share something with me, mm-hmm. and that I can just be a shoulder. And occasionally I'll try to give back a little something and say, maybe this, but don't take it if you don't want to.
Yeah.
Because my brother's always given me ideas to get through my difficult times. He says, you can try this, but don't think you have to.
So if you had some advice to give someone, could you ask permission, ask if they want to hear what your opinion is? Would that be safe? Ask. I have some feedback. Would you like it? No, not really. Okay. Maybe they'll take it later. But what they really need right now is your love. They need your support and your love just to be there. And like I said before.
Just to say, finish it. I'm always amazed. Especially this woman I knew back home. After she told me her thing, I was positive. She was the most happiest, bounciest person. And she said, I cover up, and she's just full of sorrow. Her daughter is dying of anorexia, and she can't do anything about it. So, grief. She has grief.
Mm-hmm.
You become a very good actress.
No, she didn't show.
Oh, yeah, we can put on our cardboard adult.
Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't you mention one day that a very important aspect of it is forgiving, that we must forgive our parents? I think it was you who said that. Maybe it was Greg.
Could have been.
It might have been. Yeah,
forgiveness is a lot of it. And I guess that really isn't up here under that, but it comes into me under feelings. If we're in blame, we're not forgiving. If we're in guilt, we're not forgiving. And so that is the biggest one. And if we want to carry a grudge the rest of our life, then it's our pain. You might get cancer and die. You might get something else and die. Because it's stuffed emotions. It's pain. You're carrying it around with you forever and ever and ever. You can release it, move through it, and go on. And it is possible. Remember, it's just a thought. Guilt is just a thought. Anger is just a thought. You can choose to be angry or not, and then you can choose to get it out. But anger is a thought. Because anger is not like a pure emotion. Anger is one that's stimulated by a thought of something else. So like I got angry today at the lady at the lunch table with me because she said things that I didn't agree with. It was my thought that I was angry. And she didn't do anything. You know, she would have said that to somebody else and they would have totally agreed with her. They wouldn't have been angry. So anger is like a stimulated feeling. Yes, Diane? Did you have a comment? Okay.
Seems like when you're guilty, like even after a death, a loss, you can back up that guilt. Well, I've got a right to be guilty because of this or that or the other.
And can you change it?
Well, at the time, no.
Would you like a big baseball bat? So you can beat yourself? Yeah. If I beat myself with this baseball bat, is it going to help the guilt go away?
Maybe tomorrow. Hopefully you'll have a little bit of better outlook.
So guilt is unforgiveness of yourself. And what did Jesus teach us? That we are all forgiven. So quit beating yourself. So I love you. Keep communications current. Yes, Diane?
I don't agree that you have to be. It's necessary to forgive somebody. Not necessarily your parents, but if you're in grief over something that somebody did that affected you, I think you can get beyond the grief without forgiving what they did.
If it's something you want to carry around with you, then it's wasting energy. Well, if you can let go of it, that's forgiving, I feel, and of your own. It's not acknowledging that what they did was right or wrong, or good or bad. It's just saying that I don't have to deal with this anymore because it wasn't mine.
We don't have to forget when we can forgive. I mean,
right.
Yeah. What?
We don't have to forget when we forgive. You fooled me once, shame on you, but you fooled me twice, you know, don't shame on me. You can forgive the other person to get the monkey off your back. But still remember that person, and if that person doesn't grow or improve or whatever, you can withdraw.
Right.
You know, but you can still forgive them to get to
And if you think about that person and you feel pain, then I believe you haven't totally forgiven them. Yes?
I think the reason that made such an impression on me is I have a cousin to whom I'm close, and I have known someone else in my life the same way, who held grievances against their long-deceased mother for many mistakes she had made in both instances in raising these people. And she was a very difficult mother, and they were never able to forgive her in their adult life. It just seemed like it always was like a cancerous sore there.
It is. There was a gal in my family mapping class who had a mother that could not raise children, basically. And she said that she could never forgive her. If that's true for you, then you're carrying a big sword around in your side, and it's only your side because your mother doesn't care anymore. And they, you know, just whatever words can help you move through that. They did the best they had with what they had at the time and the knowledge they had. Part of me believes that we choose our parents, we choose circumstances that we come into in life, and so. Their chore probably is to be able to move through forgiveness. That's why they were blessed with that mother, because their lesson is forgiveness.
How do you mean that part of you says we choose our parents?
I believe that we choose our parents before we come onto this earth. It's shared by other people too, and I own it. It's my belief, and I know that's not a lot of yours beliefs, and that's okay. But I believe we each have our own path on this life. Why are we alive? So that path for that person is learning forgiveness. And obviously they've not moved through it yet. If they're still hanging on to a person's stuff that has been dead for a long time and making their life miserable because of it, they've not moved through those lessons of forgiveness.
What kind of parents did they become, the ones who suffered from this mother?
That's a good question.
Well, far better than...
Did they know?
Good.
Good.
Pretty good.
We'll see if the grandchildren are forgiving, because I believe it's passed on too, you know, that between in the genes the feelings and stuff can come on too, not, you know, and also the tendency, you know, they say that like mental diseases are not inherited, but the tendency to is, because it's what you're raised around, or Another belief is that it's carried on in the genes too, but it's not necessarily inherited, but the tendency too. So I always believe you can break that. So when you say that you have inherited, who was it that came to me with the arthritic fingers? The arthritis. Because I want to bring that up out of Louise's book. And, you know, if you believe that anything inherited is inherited, I believe that you're powerful enough to overcome it. But I believe the tendency is inherited. And if I want to keep saying that hammer toes are inherited, I can create them. See? So leave your inheritance with your parents and let them have the stuff that was inherited and know that you are the perfect child of God and that you can heal anything that's there and that you don't have to carry on what your parents gave you. It's not, that's just an idea. You know, if it doesn't work, that's fine too, but it's kind of fun to be able to go with that. It gives us more challenge and way places to move forward in our life instead of, well, my mother was sickly and died at 62 and I will too. Yeah. Have any of you read or heard the tape or read the book of Fall of Freddie the Leaf? You have, that was brought up in Brad's class too. The Fall of Freddie the Leaf, if you don't have it, I would recommend you to get it. How many of you were kept away from funerals when you were children? How many of you, grandma died and you didn't get to go? Your uncle died and, the children stay home. How many were actively included in funerals? Good. Because then I believe you probably have better grief feelings and systems. It's those of us that were protected from it. I never went to a funeral until sixth grade when my stepfather had committed suicide. And I was my support to my mother. What I challenge you to do is teach your children, teach your grandchildren about grief, because that's how we're going to be able to pass that knowledge on. Teach them about what it's just a, you're just a thought idea. But the Fall of Freddie the Leaf is an easy way to explain death and grieving through that. I haven't listened to it for a long time, but it's called The Fall of Freddie the Leaf. Elizabeth Kubler Ross has a foreword in it, and I'm not sure who it's by. And it's a guy that reads it. Both. It's a book and it's a tape.
Do you know the author?
No, but you can find it in any popular bookstore.
Doesn't Leo Buscaglia put the tape out?
Could be. Leo Buscaglia might have that out.
I see.
Mm-hmm. In his tape loss. We talked a little bit about Bernie Siegel's books. I guess I should have brought them earlier because they don't deal so much with grief as they do with healing. This is Peace, Love, and Healing. Somebody's picked up. Oh, no, I'm blaming you. And this is Love, Medicine, and Miracles. This is the ones that I told you changed my attitude about people with terminal illness. And I would challenge you all to read this book. If you don't read, it comes out in tape form, but it's beautiful. It's wonderful to look at the possibilities of life. If you want to succumb to an illness and just be in your illness and die, then that's great. But otherwise, it's really, really challenging.
Read the title again, please.
Author is Bernie Siegel, B-E-R-N-I-E-S-I-E-G-E-L. S-I-E-G-E-L. And it's Love, Medicine, and Miracles. It's the first book he wrote. I recommend you only need to read one of them. The other one is Peace, Love, and Healing. And it was expounding on his first book. This is the first one that he wrote, and either one would be good. I'd just like to read something that was in his book here. In the ballad called Miss G, W.H. Auden poignantly expresses the relationship between disease and a loveless, frustrated life. She bicycled down to the doctor and rang the surgery bell. "Oh, doctor, I have a pain inside me and I don't feel very well." Dr. Thomas looked her over and then he looked some more, walked over to his wash basin, said, "Why didn't you come before?" Dr. Thomas sat over his dinner, though his wife was waiting to ring, rolling his bread into pellets, said, "Cancer's a funny thing. Nobody knows what the cause is, though sometimes they pretend they do. It's like a hidden assassin waiting to strike at you. Childless women get it, and men when they retire, as if there had to be some outlet for their foiled creative fire. Just an idea. Where is your foiled creative fire? A few of the questions on here, Norman Cousins, and Hilda had brought him up earlier, wrote Anatomy of an Illness. Anybody read it? It talks about how he laughed himself back to health, basically. He got Laurel and Hardy films and did anything he could to laugh, and did get rid of his disease. The questions here that you might just want to ponder, do you want to live to be 100? What happened to you in the year or two before your illness? It's one that he asked. What does your illness mean to you? One thing that Brad brought up in his grief seminar or speech the other day was that there's a secondary gain if someone's staying in depression for a long time and they're not grieving, they're not moving through. What is the gain, he asked his patients. What is the gain that you're getting from staying depressed? Well, my daughter does all the cooking for me. I don't have to go grocery shopping. I don't have to talk to people. It's very safe and secure. You know? There's a gain associated with what we do. So if you know someone that you don't feel is moving through these steps, they're staying stuck, they need professional help. Mental health is just as important or more than physical health. And for so long, we neglected mental health because that meant you needed a shrink and you were crazy. And it was so looked down upon. Be it if you get it through your clergy who is trained in counseling methods, or if you get it through a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or a good friend who can be a good support to you. I really suggest, you know, when you need that person to talk to, it's not awful. It doesn't make you a bad person to ask for help. Why did you need this illness? Just some questions come up in Norman Cousins' books. Why did he answer the illness?
Did Norman Cousins answer the question?
He probably does in his book. Those here, there's big paragraphs after those I didn't read, but I just thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Just to ponder on those questions, you know, why did you need this illness? Is it your escape from life? Is it old pain that you've never resolved? Well, so you look at religion with death. You know, your spiritual step here. And everybody has their own beliefs, and that's okay. It doesn't mean that anybody is right or wrong. It means that you're on your path and believing. And whether you look at the spiritualness of the death, or as we've looked at metaphysics, I look at spiritualness, any spiritualness in any religion, if you're truly spiritual, or if you're just going to church and saying, yes, I'm worshiping God, so I'll go to heaven someday, which is the way I grew up. That's what I believed being spiritual was. Spiritual, to me, is metaphysical because it's beyond the physical. Spirit is not something I can cut out of my heart or my arm and say, here's my spirit, you want to see? So it's beyond the physical. So to be spiritual, or to be really connected with God, is really the same thing as metaphysics. So when you hear that word now, you'll all know that it means something that's not quite so scary. And we've really been dealing with it all the time. And yet so many people that want to resist it, you know, think it's bunk, it's not, you know, it's awful stuff, it's the devil, you know, whatever you want to give it to, is just not opening and looking that everybody really participates in it if they're really, really being spiritual to me. I'd like to share a poem with you, and then we'll close. We're a little early if there's discussion afterwards, or if anybody would like to share in my books, you may do that. Brad did a class the other night on Robert Frost and theology. Did any of you go to that? Was it great? I wish I would have gone because Robert Frost is one of my favorite poets. And I just like to read a poem that reads a lot to me. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
That's one that he read that he gave us.
Yeah, I saw it was on his list. Yeah, that's great. I have to credit my fifth grade teacher, who of course it's always the one you hate that you remember the most. She was right out of college, Rebecca Corey. Do any of you know Rebecca Corey? She drove a little red Toyota, we called it the Red Tomato, over in Tacoma. And our paths crossed a few other times. She ended up being the one-room school teacher up at Winton on Stevens Pass. And I saw her wedding announcement, or license announcement in the paper a few years ago, too. And it's like, Rebecca finally got married. But she made us memorize a lot of poetry. And I talked to a gal at my 20-year class reunion a couple weeks ago, and she said, I still hate poetry. And it's like, well, I have to thank Rebecca because I love poetry. If it relates to me, if it doesn't, it's bunk, you know. But there is a lot of poetry, and that was one of the poems that I really enjoyed. And Erin Somerville, who I mentioned at meditation the other night, she read that poem at the end of her presentation at our Laughter and Play workshop. And Karen probably remembers, I hit her and I said, I know what poem she's going to read. And she did. She read my poem. And after that, I hadn't read it for a long time, went and bought a book at a used bookstore and got a copy of it and wrote it in my journal. But that's really all I have to share. Any other questions or comments? One thing you might want to do, I was going to have us do it in class, but I decided I didn't want to risk that. But you kind of know each other a little bit. You might even want to do it, you probably won't have much time later tonight, but you would even now if you wanted. To find an active listener and to practice active listening, pick someone in the group that you don't know and just sit right across from them in a private setting and tell them about a grief that you've had. And let the person that's listening, all they can do is just keep eye contact and not make any responses and just let you totally talk. But that's a good way if you can set that up with a friend to be able to say things to a parent or to a son that's died or whatever. It's like sometimes you can just babble and babble and babble and that person's there and they're listening, but they're not going to fix you. They're not going to fix it. But it's kind of a fun thing to do and it's very healing. And it also teaches the listener how to listen. But you set the rules when you start and say, you know, I will be here and I will be supporting you with my eyes only. And I wasn't willing to risk that and get into the feelings that we might have gotten into today because I know I would have. But that was a suggestion I want to pass on. So. Yes?
Another thing that's good about to practice being a good listener is after you've listened to someone, to repeat back to them some of the things that they have told you, and this is what you're telling me, this is what I hear you saying, and really concentrate on what they're saying. I took a class from a girl over in Tacoma to be a facilitator. I belong to WICS in Tacoma, and so I'm going to see if I can maybe help other people the way that they've helped me. And so this was one of the things that she said, if you can listen to people without saying anything, or if you can listen to them and then every once in a while repeat back what they've said so that they know that you are indeed listening to them, and it really helps them. And I just wanted to, one thing in passing you were saying about things to say to people when they've had a loss and you don't know what to say and you're very uncomfortable, you can, one thing not to say to them that just kind of curls the hair on the back of their head is, "Oh my, you're doing well."
Oh yeah.
Oh.
That's another one.
That is one that just sends chills, and I don't care how long you've been grieving or how long you've been hurting, it just doesn't do well. But you can say that, like some of the things that you said,
yeah,
that you're really hurting for them, and that you can never say that you agree, that you know how
they feel.
Because regardless, you may have had the same loss, but
they
your
don't
loss
care.
Isn't their loss.
They don't care. Right now, it's only theirs. Yeah, when my father was in Harborview, as I shared the other day, I was staying at my mother's, and she was talking to someone on the phone, and she goes, "Here, Rosalie, you tell Chet how your dad's doing." And it's like, I can't tell anybody else. It's like I was the medical person. I was going over it with my brothers and my sisters. And it's like, I just can't tell anybody else. And she goes, "Well, you're so strong. You've just been so strong, you know. You can be strong." And it's like, I don't want to be strong. I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry now, you know. And the word strong does not have anything to do with grief. So just put it out of your vocabulary.
I'd like to share about listening a little bit. I heard a minister speak at a convention I went to for retired teachers. And they always have a kind of a memorial service for the retired teachers who have died the past year. And he spoke, and he said his wife was dying of cancer. And one night she said to him, "Well, tonight, you just listen, and I'll talk." And she did, and you could tell from the way he told it that usually she was not the talker in the family. But he says, "I learned an awful lot that night." And it, you know, it made me feel a lot better.
Yeah, and I have trouble with that a lot because I'm a talker. You can ask the people in this room that know me. I do. I like to talk a lot, and I used to let my mind wander and go off and think of what I was going to say next instead of listening.
It's hard to be a listener.
It's challenging. It's not hard. It's challenging.
Yes.
I try to change that because I like to say it's hard to do things too, but why should I affirm that it's hard? It's challenging, and I'm learning, and it's getting easier.
But without listening, there's no communication.
Right. You might as well not even be there. Well, thank you all very much. I want to encourage you all to please write on your evaluation forms. As you all know, this is my first time teaching, and I really need to know through Karen what are my strong points and what my weak points are. So I really look to you, and I'm really thankful that I have attracted you all into my life. And it's been very interesting how to see how this week the three groups of classes have so melded. And I thank all of you for attracting that, because I really believe that it's just really worked together as a neat support group between all three of us instructors to be able to carry on the learnings from each class. It's been exciting for me instead of learning a single thing, you know, and totally being separated. And I believe, you know, that all of you have just learned and grown. And I thank you for all remaining open and not stabbing me in the back.